Looking at externalist views, these have first a real world component for our meaning, and secondly, a social or social interaction component. That's the character of the prevailing externalist doctrines. According to the first, the real world component, a word or an expression picks out it picks out the essential nature of the things to which it refers, and this essential nature is often to be discovered. But that's its reference. Its reference is to things by virtue of their essential nature. The social component says that words get their meaning in a common language through social interaction, and we don't know the right meaning of the word, but we learn it in the common language. The internalist view, on the other hand, says that a word is just a collection of its properties, a word expression. So a linguistic expression is just a collection of properties, phonetic. One of the ways in which language, Saussurean arbitrariness called. And when you learn a word, you pick up the association. And if, say, Jerry Fodor is correct, that's about all you learn, the association. Or maybe some things, you know, a few options as to how the semantic features would be there. Well, these are two different pictures. And what I argued this morning is that the phenomena that are addressed in terms of wide content are real enough, but they can be accounted for perfectly straightforwardly if there's any account at all, which there often isn't. But if there's any account at all, there's a perfectly straightforward account in terms of narrow content, an internalist account, which is in fact tacitly presupposed in the externalist approaches anyway. So in terms of what's presupposed in the externalist approaches, there's already an explanation. And therefore, it doesn't seem that there's any need to go on to this more complex and basically non-naturalist doctrine. That's what I argued this morning. Now, that doesn't mean there are no questions left here. There are plenty of questions left. With regard to the real-world component issue, we're left with a very interesting question. The question is there a relation R? Is there a relation R such that R expression, you know, thing in the world, where R has the stipulated properties of reference, standard properties of reference. So is there such a relation? I was arguing this morning that there's no such concept in natural language, but that doesn't mean that there might not be such a concept in a theory of language. In general, in a theory of language, we're going to have notions that don't exist in the language itself. And as long as we don't get confused about this, we may turn sensibly to ask the question whether that relation exists. Is there, in fact, a reference-like relation between words and things, say? With respect to the social interaction component, I think if you look at the descriptions, at least the better ones, say, by Tyler Burge, they're, I think, quite accurate. There's nothing wrong with the descriptions. So Tyler Burge, say, in his articles, gives detailed and often rather perceptive accounts of how a group of reasonable people, you know, folks like us, who are trying to are seeking some sort of common ground. You know, they want to be able to communicate more efficiently. They're seeking a common ground of belief and expression of belief, how they might modify their usage. In internalist terms, that would mean drop certain linguistic expressions and pick up others. Often the changes would be maybe in a few semantic features or something. And how they might do this, they might decide to do this under many circumstances with deference to people who know more about some topic and therefore have better decisions about what are useful concepts and so on and so forth. That's if you look at his articles, I think that's basically what he describes. And I think things like that happen. You know, reasonable people do adjust their concepts and defer to others and try to find common ground and so on. But it's not a matter of finding the real meaning of the word in the common language. There's no such thing as the common language. The reason nobody can make a sensible proposal about common language is that there's nothing there to seek. And as for the real meaning, it doesn't mean anything. You know, it's people have what's in their eye language. One of the aspects of eye language that's readily modifiable is the Saussurean arbitrariness, the association of sound and concept, and that you do all the time. And whenever you're learning a new, what's called learning a new word, you do all the time. And in certain situations of social interaction of the kind that, say, Burge describes, it might be entirely reasonable for people to explicitly decide to introduce words slightly different than the ones they had, like Burt and arthritis and so on. And many of his accounts are perfectly reasonable. I don't mean to question them. I just say they're not saying anything about language. They're telling you something about how reasonable people might behave in certain circumstances with regard to modifications of their eye language. Nothing is added to that description, as far as I can see, by bringing in an externalist theory, except confusion. And that's a purely internalist description, notice. It's not a description totally in terms of eye language, because it makes reference to people's interests and goals and decisions and so on. But if you're talking about all of human life, you're not just talking about language. And this is talking about something of the scale of all of human life. For that reason, it's very unlikely that there's going to be much to say about this topic. That is, there'll be particular things to say about particular cases, but virtually nothing of any generality or of any theoretical interest to say, because it's verging towards something like the study of everything, and we know that you can't say anything about that. I mean, these descriptions are like descriptions of how people live their lives. You know? And, you know, interesting topic, but it's the kind of topic you write novels about, not make theories about. Crucially, it does not lead to any such exotic notion as common public language. Well, there's another familiar argument for common public language, which is a classic one, and I want to give that one. And it also relates to these other matters about reference. This is the one that goes back to Frege, and this one is implicit, at least, in the work of non-Fregeans, like Kripke and Putnam, for example, who were specifically breaking from Frege, explicitly so, claiming, as using Putnam's phrase, that meaning isn't in the head. The Fregean story goes like this. We begin, take Sinn und Bedeutung, which is classic account. We begin by assuming what he calls a common store of thoughts. Okay, so we begin with a common store of thoughts, and Frege, without arguing about it, he simply says the existence of a common store of thoughts, that's a common human possession, one can hardly deny. It's perfectly obvious. So he just assumes it. No further discussion. Okay. So one can hardly deny that there is a common store of thoughts, which is a common human possession, and therefore we assume it. Then we move to a common public language in which these thoughts are expressed. And although meanings are in the mind, the meanings are objective things. Everybody's got the same one, you know, even though there is something in the individual mind, but that's something like an image or something like that. So we move to the common public language in which the thoughts are expressed, and then the third point, which is, you know, could be theoretically dissociated from these, is to present a description of the common public language in terms of the notion reference, Bedeutung for him. A relation like R, a relation which holds between words and things, expressions and things generally. Okay. And of course, a mode of setting reference, which is, you know, sense or meaning or something like that, Zin for him. Mode of fixing reference. So this is Bedeutung, and this is Sinn. Well, as I mentioned, Frege had to make up technical terms for this, because the German words didn't mean that. But that's okay. These are technical terms. He, in other words, is answering that question up there positively. He's saying there is such a relation. Well, that's the picture. And if moving in that way, we get a kind of an argument for common public language, given that it can't be denied that there's a common store of thoughts. Common public language. Meaning mode of fixing reference. Okay. Yeah, just a way of fixing, you know, these words. Yeah. The technique, the way of fixing the reference. There's the argument. Well, let's start from the beginning. Can it be, maybe the story is right, but it surely isn't obvious. It's not as obvious as Frege claims. That is, it certainly can be denied that there's a common store of thoughts. In fact, it had been denied quite plausibly long before. It was denied, for example, in the 18th century critique of the theory of ideas. Theory of ideas was sort of a big issue in the 17th and 18th century. By the late 18th century, an influential and important critique of the theory of ideas was developing, and in several places it was based on the notion that became in the 20th century the ordinary language critique, that this was simply misreading of giving the wrong grammar to the expression. These were systematically notions like John has a thought or John has an idea or a thought are what Ryle, 150 years later, would call a systematically misleading expression, an expression which looks as if the terms in it are referential. This looks as if it's like John has a watch or a diamond. But that's a faulty analogy, because in fact John has an idea or John has a thought just means John thinks. And John has the idea X means John thinks that X. So there's no thing mentioned at all. This, as far as I know, this critique was first made by the French encyclopedist du Marsay, and later it became famous with Thomas Reid, the Scottish common sense philosopher, who was more in the center of the tradition. And that was a major part of the philosophical tradition, and, you know, certainly a plausible view. In the 20th century, with Ryle and Wittgenstein and so on, this became a cliché. Well, maybe it's wrong, but it doesn't seem obviously wrong. And if it's right, then you certainly can deny that there's a common store of ideas, because there aren't any ideas at all. People think, they think more or less alike, and that's all there is to it. One can certainly take that view. And you have to show that there's something beyond that. To say that if people think alike, they therefore are thoughts that they share, in itself is no argument. It would be like saying, if people look alike, there must be shapes that they share. And that's obvious nonsense. So a further argument is required to show that there is a common store of thoughts. Now, of course, there will be domains in which there will be a common store of thoughts, and because you create them that way. Say, mathematics, which is actually what Frege was interested in. There it makes sense to say there's a common store of thoughts. You know, if you're a Platonist, they're actually there. If you're an intuitionist, you construct them or whatever. But there you can say there's a common store of thoughts. However, in the natural world, in the study of people in the natural world, you can't make that move. You have to show that there's a common store of thoughts, and it's hard to see how one could do that. So the very first step seems highly dubious. And if you don't make the first step, you obviously don't go to the second step. I mean, if you do make the first step, the second step doesn't follow automatically, but it certainly doesn't follow if you don't accept the first step. And there's no reason to accept the first step unless somebody offers a reason, and the only reason that's offered is basically the grammatical analogy, and that obviously isn't enough. Or the fact that people think alike, but again, not enough. Well, what about the idea that let me just say that when we say, there's something a little different between questioning the notion of common language and questioning the notion of ideas and thoughts. I mean, common languages are proposed as entities, And there we have very solid grounds for rejecting the proposal. It's not just that nobody can tell us what they are. We know why there aren't any. There's a good theoretical understanding of the issue which explains exactly why there aren't any such things. Why talk about common languages like talk about absolute regions. So in that case, rejection of the proposed entity is based on pretty firm grounds. Now, in the case of thoughts and ideas, nobody knows anything. You know, there's basically nothing known about the topic of thinking and having ideas and so on and so forth. So therefore, one is not on strong grounds in rejecting the proposal that there are thoughts and ideas. Maybe there are. Since there's no theory and there's no theoretical understanding in any terms, you can't say these are the wrong terms. All you can say is something weaker in this case, namely there doesn't seem to be any substantive argument, and hence a big gap to be filled before we can proceed. And of course, given that there's no argument for it, one will obviously take the more limited position that you don't accept it. You don't accept proposals if there's no argument for them. You just reject them until an argument's given, even if they have no reason for rejecting them. In the case of common language, there's actually a reason for rejecting it, so there's a stronger position. What about the third point? I mean, even if we put the... So, in short, I think we're... Whatever the answer to this question is, we're on firm grounds in rejecting this one, and we're on good grounds, if not solid grounds, for rejecting this one. The good grounds are that there's no argument for adding to the to our ontology those entities, and therefore we won't do it, even though we have no better theory in some other terms because there's no theory. Okay. What about the third point? Well, we're still left with that. Is there a relation of reference that holds between words and things, you know, expressions and things in the world? And is there a way of fixing that reference? Is there something like Bedeutung and Sinn, let's say? That's the question. Now, if you look at the best work on reference from Frege to the present, there's a characteristic move that's made, which is too fast. You see it, for example, in one of the best books on the topic, Gareth Evans' book, Varieties of Reference, actually a collection of essays after he died. In his book, Varieties of Reference, one of the best contemporary philosophical works on reference, he begins the exposition by making a statement which is absolutely true, namely, people use words to refer to things. So that's the beginning. He's introducing the topic. He says, look, people use words to refer to things. And that's what we're going to be studying, reference. And he then makes a move from people use words to refer to things like John used the word London to refer to Paris, let's say. He moves from that to words refer to things. That is the existence of that relation. And there's no mark of that transition. It's just one paragraph we have people use words to refer to things, and the next paragraph we have words refer to things. And then we're off and running on a theory of reference and meaning. If words are used to refer to things, then there's a means of fixing the reference, and that'll be the sense, and then we move on to the problems. But that's a transition that has to be justified. I mean, you can't just make it. You have to justify it. And I think you'll search in vain for any justification for it. In fact, it's usually assumed, so tacitly assumed, that people even think they have intuitions about the technical notion reference, as in the Twin Earth discussion, which is all, what Dan Dennett once called intuition pumping, pumping up your intuitions about to try to figure out what you think about these things. And of course, even if the technical concept exists, you can't have intuitions. But it is so taken for granted that this move is legitimate that we have, intricate discussions about what our intuitions are about the invented technical term. Well, that won't do. Now, we have to be careful not to confuse ourselves about another issue. Suppose that a theorist of semantics, or a linguistic theorist or whatever, is working on, let's say formal semantics of some kind or some theory of semantics, and decides to set up things which he calls semantic values. Okay. and words used, and that relation is, let's say, the relation R. Okay. In fact, R will then be assigned the properties of reference. So John will have a relation R to a certain semantic value. Okay. So we now have some domain, call it D, of entities. Maybe we'll call them semantic values, or maybe we'll call them elements of a model, or pieces of a discourse representation, or some whatever. Here it becomes a question of which theory you like, but I don't really care. So let's just call them semantic values. We have a domain of these things. We have a relation that holds between expressions and these things, and then you can do a lot of work. You can ask how, if you put together expressions in a certain way, how do you get things out here that you're referring to? Okay. Or, for example, you can develop a kind of reasonable theory of anaphora. In fact, a lot of theories of anaphora, typically theories of anaphora, are developed in these terms. Okay. Theories of anaphora mean, a relation between a pronoun and an antecedent, that kind of question. So a typical relation, let's take the examples I gave last time. He thinks, or sometime, he thinks John is a genius. John thinks he is a genius. His mother thinks John is a genius. Okay, so take those three sentences. And we note the following facts, that in this one, he might, so we'll say question mark, the pronoun might be referentially dependent on John, meaning whatever John refers to, that's what the pronoun refers to. It's not necessary, but it's possible. Okay. The person who uses that sentence could be intending a common reference to the pronoun and John. Similarly here, the person who expresses this sentence could be intending a common reference to the pronoun in John, but in this case, no. The person could not be intending a common reference. Could turn out that he refers to John because, like, maybe there's only one person in the world or something, or maybe some other John was referred to in an earlier discourse, and he is picking up its reference from that. So by transitivity, it will be the same reference as John, but we know that he's not picking up its intended reference from John. Okay, that we know in the first case. So we know different things about those sentences. Those are facts about language. The theory of anaphora, or binding theory as it's sometimes called, attempts to explain these facts. And a possible way to explain them is by setting up a domain D with a relation R and giving semantic values to the relevant terms, and to say that in this kind of configuration, which you then proceed to define, the pronoun he can't pick as its reference, as the thing to which it's related by R, the element in D to which John refers. Okay, that's a way of building up a theory of anaphora, whereas the other two cases it can't. That's perfectly sensible. Maybe right, maybe wrong, but it's perfectly sensible. It's on a par with some theory of phonetics. Notice it's all totally internalist. You haven't gotten anywhere near the world yet. The world doesn't have to exist. The domain D is a set of syntactic objects. They're called semantic values, but you don't want to be confused about that, though I think many people are. The semantic values have nothing to do with semantics. They're syntactic values. They're syntactic entities. The domain D is a collection of syntactic objects, formal objects, which you claim in this theory are in the mind. Semantic values are on a par with phonetic features, let's say. Phonetic features aren't in the world. They're in your head. In the world, there's noises. And the array of phonetic features gets converted into noises via the performance systems, and noises get interpreted in terms of phonetic features, again, by virtue of via the performance systems. But nobody would confuse phonetic features with noises, right? Like, if you have a voice, somebody writes down voice, say aspirated labial or something like that. Nobody thinks that. I just wrote down a noise. Okay, I wrote a symbol for a collection of syntactic objects, phonetic features. And universal phonetics will be a theory about this, what these objects are, in general terms, a syntactic theory. We use the word syntax now in the broad sense to include anything about mental representations. There's also a narrow sense which refers to part of that theory, namely the part that involves, you know, phrases and stuff like that. But use it in the broad sense to be just the theory of mental representations. Then phonetic features are syntactic objects, and the domain D is syntactic objects. To go from phonetic features to the outside world is no trivial matter. You need a theory of articulation and perception and so on and so forth, and it's hard to work out. To go from the domain D to the outside world is certainly no less hard. In fact, it's not obvious that it's possible at all. The postulation of the set of phonetic values is justified on the usual best theory terms. That is, you claim that you can get a person who proposes a theory of distinctive features, let's say, or something like that, is in effect claiming that the way to understand speaking and hearing, you know, articulation and perception, is to set up this level of syntactic representation, and then to relate that level of syntactic representation to noises by way of universal properties. Okay, a phonetic representation is something that is that must meet the property that its language, its interpretation is language independent. Once you get down to phonetic representation, everything from there on is outside the particular language in question. If that's not true, you didn't get down to phonetic representation. It's an interface between the language faculty and other systems. And that's what's the meaning of the notion. If you fail to get to the point where everything is language independent from that point on, you know you didn't have the right theory of phonetics. And the theory of semantic values, or theory of D, would have to have the same property. It's an interface. It's the point at which the language faculty interrelates with other faculties of the mind, conceptual faculties, intentional faculties, whatever they may be, okay? And the interpretation of D by these other faculties must be language independent if this is a valid description of the interface. Okay? Well, it might be. That would mean that R, the proposal should be that R and D are on a par with what's called phonetic form, PF, and some relation, you know, whatever it's called, some relation P, that one might set up relating expressions to phonetic form. Okay, so part of the path from linguistic expressions to phonetic form would be involved. There are lots of such relations, but let's pick one of them, call it P. And R and D would have the same status. They're all totally internalist. They're all syntactic. They don't, in themselves, they don't have anything to say about the world. They don't even require that a world exists. You know, it could be all that could be happening is your head exists. You know, and these theories would work exactly the same way. Well, is this the right way to move? Maybe, but if it is, notice what the properties of these elements D or what I'm saying now incidentally applies to every form of formal semantics or linguistic semantics that is set up: model theoretic semantics, discourse representation semantics, anything I know about has these properties. It sets up a domain D of syntactic objects which have nothing to do with the world, as far as we know. But have to be. They may. Like one may argue that it's plausible to argue. You know, the argument that one should give is that the syntactic representation D, say something about possible worlds, is more transparently related to the actual world than, say, linguistic expressions themselves are. That when you get down to D, you have a kind of transparent relation to the world. That would be like saying that when you go from, say, abstract phonological features to phonetic features, you now have a more transparent picture of the world. That amounts to saying it's a real interface, that there's going to be a language-independent interpretation. That's the property it has to satisfy. Okay? That's what it means to say it's a more transparent relation. And maybe, but maybe not. Some reasons to think that the answer is no come about very quickly if you start playing with these sentences. So suppose instead of John, I have the young man, let's say. Same here. So the first sentence says, he thinks the young man is a genius. Second, the young man thinks he's a genius. The third, his mother thinks the young man is a genius. Okay, the relations of anaphora remain the same. Okay, same relations. So therefore, if our theory of anaphora is formulated in terms of R and D, what we'll say is the same thing. The young man picks out an element of D, let's call it small d, and we state the anaphora theory exactly as before in terms of the relation R, which we read reference, and when a pronoun picks out a certain element of capital D as its reference. Okay. So far, everything's fine. Suppose we replace the young man, however, by the average man. He thinks the average man is a genius. The average man thinks he's a genius. His mother thinks the average man is a genius. Notice the third one has a certain oddity about it, which it has to do with stress. There's some funny facts that are interacting here about backwards anaphora, as it's called, with regard to lack of stress. If you don't stress the young man, the average man up here, you also get funny relations. But that we can abstract away from. In fact, if you like, we can just look at the first two. In case the third sounds funny, which it should, actually, because it's adding an extra property. He thinks the average man is a genius. The average man thinks he's a genius. Okay, same relations. Therefore, the same interpretation. We're going to give the same interpretation. Is related to some element, call it D prime, in capital D, and by the relation R, and we, therefore, give the same theory of anaphora. Well, suppose it doesn't have to be a definite noun phrase, could be a name. So suppose we pick we'll call John Doe the name of the average man. Okay, that's if there's anything to the notion common language, this is in it. That's a kind of standard convention. So John Doe is the average man. We accept that common convention. We now say he thinks that John Doe is a genius. John Doe thinks he's a genius. His mother thinks John Doe is a genius, same relations of anaphora. And we explain he the same way. Well, what's the point of this exercise? Remember that the point of moving to D was supposed to be that we're getting to a transparent relation to the world. That is, a relation to the world which will have a uniform, language-independent interpretation within things. And we don't seem to be getting there at all, because John Doe and the average man, nobody believes they pick out things in the world. I mean, we understand them, right? You know, the average man means add together all the men and divide by the number and so on and so forth. But there certainly is no thing in the world to which the phrase the average man refers, or to which John Doe refers. And nobody's confused about that. I mean, absolutely nobody, I hope. If the theory of anaphora is the justification, the internalist justification for setting up D, which it usually is. See, if it's not the theory of anaphora, it's something very much like it. Notice that the theory of anaphora is at the core of what's called the logic of language. You know, the relation of variables to, you know, what binds them and so on. And in fact, if you extend it on, you get right into quantifiers. And anything that could be called logic of language is going to have exactly these properties. And it always works exactly the same way if the terms that you're picking out might have reference, and if the terms you're picking out certainly have no reference, where I borrow this term reference and pretending we understand it. Okay. So in other words, the internalist justification, for such as it is, for setting up the domain D seems to be absolutely irrelevant to relationship to the world. In that respect, it's quite unlike phonetic form. The move to phonetic form really does take you to something like a transparent picture of the image of the actual world, whereas this doesn't seem to take you anywhere. Same goes on if we turn to other expressions. So take, it brings good health own rewards. Good health brings its own rewards. Its rewards are what make good health won't write it, worth striving for, let's say, you know, worth trying to achieve. All right, those three expressions, if you think about them, have exactly the formal properties of these, and we have the same result. In the second one, it is anaphorically dependent on good health. In the first, it cannot be. In the third, again, it is. Can be, at least. Okay? So we have exactly the same relationship. If we're going to explain the phenomena in terms of the relation D and the domain D, the relation R and the domain D, we will set up an element of D. Since we're making up D, it's a syntactic object. We can give it any properties we like. We'll put into capital D an entity, call it G, let's say, to which the phrase good health bears the relation R. Okay, and then we'll get the same theory of anaphora. Again, I doubt that anybody is confused into thinking that one of the things in the world is good health. To understand these sentences, you don't have to assume that among the various things in the world, there's good health, which has these properties. And it would obviously be a mistake to make any such move. Nevertheless, the relations work exactly the same. The relations of anaphora and dependence and so on work exactly the same way. To give a final example, take the sentence, there was a flaw. In the argument, and the argument was flawed. For all relevant purposes, these are synonymous. We can, in fact, assume them to be synonymous. But anaphora works differently for them. So in the first try adding, and it was quickly found, and ask about the reference of it. Okay. Well, in the first case, there was a flaw in the argument and it was quickly found. It has anaphoric properties, as a pronoun usually does. It picks up its reference from flaw. In the second case, there's no interpretation. There's nothing for it to pick up its reference from. So it must be referring to some other thing. You know, I don't know, like the chair was quickly found or something like that. The way we handle that in the internalist theory of, say, formal semantics is to say that flaw bears the relation of reference to some thing in the world, namely, or some thing in D, let's say, capital D. In the second sentence, for purely structural reasons, there is no word that can pick up a relation that can have the relation R to some element of D. So therefore, in the second case, we can't run through the theory of anaphora. That's fine, except that we now have the story, that we now have the case that two expressions, which are, in fact, synonymous. In fact, if you look closer, they may even have the same underlying representation at the relevant level as has been proposed. Though they are, for all relevant purposes, synonymous, have different relations to the domain D. Okay. As shown by the same anaphora facts. Well, again, that seems to show us that we're not getting anywhere near semantics. In fact, maybe we're getting farther away from it, but we're certainly not getting anywhere near it. Semantics is the study of the relation between languages and the world. You know, it's not the study of things of syntax. It's not the study of relationships internal to particular systems of mental representations any more than speech analysis is the study of internal of phonology. They're different subjects. You may go on if you like, but you see the point. The point is setting up, though one can set up a relation D, as people do when they do model theoretic semantics or discourse representation or other kinds of theories of semantic values, one can certainly do it, but it has to be justified on the same terms as setting up phonetic values. You got to show that it's carrying you toward, that it's giving you it's enabling you to build up an explanation, you know, an account of things like anaphora, along, say, the lines I suggested, or that it's carrying you towards a more transparent picture, true interface relation. And that's certainly not easy. In fact, doesn't seem how it could be possible at all. Notice there might be an occasional resemblance between the relation R and some relation between words and things in the world. And that could perfectly well happen. But that would be irrelevant, you know, just be an irrelevant accident. And notice again, of course, that we have no intuitions whatsoever about R and B, any more than we have intuitions about phonetic features and their relationships to phonological representations. You can't have intuitions about such things. Suppose that somebody succeeds in justifying this theory of R and B. It's not so trivial. I mean, people who work in things like model theory and so on describe what they're doing as semantics, which is very curious. But because it has nothing to do with semantics. They describe it as semantics, which is already a mistake, and they assume that it's justified, which is kind of funny. No phonologist could get away with that. You know? I mean, if a phonologist simply stipulated some set of things, and I say, okay, that's what phonetic values are, and some relation between them, and then went on to build enormous theories on this, people would just laugh. I mean, there's no point even looking at the theory of phonetic values, phonetic features, unless you give some reason to show that it's an interface, which is, you know, what people like Roman Jakobson and others were trying to do. That's why Roman Jakobson spent a lot of time trying to show that what he thought were the distinctive features had uniform acoustic interpretations and uniform articulatory interpretations and so on. That's what one, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, but that's what you have to do. If he had just said, look, I like these features and now I can, you know, make formal theories about them, people wouldn't have even laughed, you know. Question is, why can you do it on the conceptual side of syntax if you can't do it on the perceptual articulatory side of syntax? Well, the answer is you shouldn't. I mean, you can kind of get away with it more easily at the conceptual side because we don't know much about the interface. In the case of the phonetic side, I mean, we have this language faculty over here, part of the mind, and it appears that it has two interface relations. And that just seems like a fact. It seems to interface with the articulatory perceptual systems, and it seems to interface with the conceptual intentional systems. That seems to be the two places where the language faculty interacts with other parts of the mind. At this interface, a lot is known about what's over here. Okay, I mean, you know a lot about motions of the articulatory musculature and about sound waves and that kind of thing. At this interface, basically nothing is known. It's mostly mysterious. That's not to say that you don't have evidence about the interface. You have plenty of evidence, in fact, pretty reliable evidence about what expressions, you know, what relationships there are, semantic relations there are between expressions, relations of entailment, and so on and so forth. You have plenty of evidence, but you don't have any theoretical understanding of the thing at the other side of the interface. So therefore, it's kind of easier to fall into mistakes. And it seems to me that all of this stuff may not be a mistake, but it has to be justified. To think that it doesn't have to be justified is a mistake. I mean, maybe it's the right move. Maybe people made the right guess. But it requires a justification. Short of that, it's on a par with the theory of distinctive features that somebody picked out of a hat. Okay. Now, when you look at the cases, it's not clear that there's going to be an easy answer. The way the cases seem to work, it appears that the theory of anaphora works by structural properties, not by true semantic properties. That's why things like the average man and the young man come out alike. Semantically, they're radically different, but syntactically, they're alike. And that seems what's relevant for the theory of anaphora. And this seems to run across the board, as far as I know. Theory of quantifiers, I mean, everything in natural language just seems to care about the form. Doesn't seem to care about what the interface relations are, which suggests that we're still working internal to the system. We haven't yet gotten to whatever the interface must be. Okay, and it's not in the least clear that any of this is getting nearer to it. We're still looking at Frege's notion. Suppose that the internalist postulation of R and D is setting up a domain D of syntactic objects and a relation R with reference like properties to expression, suppose that is justified, meaning that there's some way of interpreting the things in D, the semantic values, in the world, or in the other, at least in the other systems, in the conceptual system, then maybe from there to the world, somewhere outside the language faculty. Suppose that's true. Notice that even if that's true, it's not going to give us any justification at all for believing that there's another relationship, call it R prime, that holds between expressions and things in the world, or things in the world as they're thought to be, or whatever you like to say language refers to. Okay, we have no even accepting R and D, and figuring having, you know, having offered the proponent of R and D the conclusion that you can somehow relate D to the world. That doesn't tell us that there's a reference-like relation, a relation with the properties of reference holding between expressions and whatever this stuff is related to. Okay, this stuff here that we're granting is going to be related to whatever you think language is about. Okay, things in the world, things in, that are believed to be in the world, you know, pick your story. Even if we grant that, it doesn't say that there's going to be any reference-like relation between phrases in the language and those things. It all depends on how this stuff works out. We have a ghost of an idea about that. So we seem to have no reason at all to believe that there exists a relation of reference that holds between expressions and anything in the world. Things that we believe in, you know, you pick your theory as you like. It's kind of neutral, so we can pick anyone we want. Nor do we have the slightest reason from any of this to believe in some notion of public language. I mean, that's doing nothing. let's go on to see if there's some other, what other considerations will suggest to us about this. I mean, I want to give this, you know, every possible opportunity to justify itself. So far, no justification. Actually, these comments are not novel, incidentally. I mean, in fact, it was standardly assumed about 40 years ago that it makes no sense to suppose that words have a relation to things. Like, you know, writing in his introductory logic book 40 years ago, Peter Strawson said we have to avoid the fallacy of believing in logically proper names, meaning names in natural language that name things. He said, look, that's an obvious fallacy, and then he went on to explain it. Well, these are all indications of why it appears to be an obvious fallacy. Unfortunately, the understanding that was pretty standard at that time has mostly been lost. And we now have new approaches coming in which are making exactly the kind of moves which were criticized, in my opinion, correctly criticized by Strawson, Ryle, Wittgenstein, and others back in the period of early days of ordinary language philosophy. It's kind of striking that if you read the contemporary literature, you almost never find a reference to the fact that these notions were criticized at one time. I mean, there's no refutation of the criticisms. They seem to have been just forgotten. You know? But the criticisms are pretty reasonable, just as the 18th century criticisms that made essentially the same points were pretty reasonable. I don't think they can simply be dismissed. In fact, they seem correct. You know? So well, let's have a look at, let's take a closer look at some actual words and see whether it would make sense to pursue the quest for some relationship between words and things. So take, for example, I don't know, take some simple words. Take, say, the word book. Okay, some of the things in the world are books, some aren't books. So that looks like a candidate for a term that might refer to things. Well, the word book has some curious properties. For one thing, a book can be concrete or it can be abstract. Okay. If I say the book weighs 5 pounds, it's concrete, because only concrete things weigh 5 pounds. If I say John is writing a book in his head, it's abstract. Okay. Or if I make it definite, the book that John wrote in his head, that's abstract. In fact, the book that John wrote is abstract, even if it was published. Okay? So the term book can freely refer either to an abstract or a concrete thing. However, a single occurrence of it can simultaneously refer both to the abstract version and the concrete version. So if I say the book which weighs 5 pounds, or which John, which weighs 5 pounds, was written by John. well, the thing that raised 5 pounds had no relationship to John at all. He may not even know it exists. But the phrase, the book, is its full referential phrase, is referring to something which is simultaneously abstract and concrete. Well, nothing in the world can be simultaneously abstract and concrete. So there can be nothing in the world. There can be nothing in the world that is the denotatum of book, because nothing in the world can be both concrete and abstract. Actually, this is, it's not an accident about book. Virtually most words are like that. Same with definite noun phrases. Take the deck of cards, which is missing a queen. Is too worn to use. Okay. In the matrix clause, the deck of cards is too worn to use. It's obviously some kind of physical thing, because that's the only kind of thing that worn out, sort of broken. On the other hand, when the deck of cards that's missing a queen is some abstract object. Okay. In fact, some kind of set. And so we might ask what kind of a concrete object the book of cards that's too worn to use is. What kind of concrete object is it? Notice that it's not what's called technically a muriological sum. It's not an entity put together out of its parts, right? Absolutely not. Can't be that. The left corner of one of the cards does not have the same status in the deck as the card itself. But if it was a sum, that would be true. So it's not a sum in the sense of the part-whole calculus. It's not a set, obviously. In fact, there's nothing intelligible that it is, not that anybody knows about, at least. Nevertheless, we use it to refer to things. And in fact, again, we use it both concretely and abstractly. This is quite common. And notice there's nothing paradoxical in terms of the actual notion of referring. I mean, just as there's nothing, I mean, since I can refer to London without even mentioning it, I can say he was referring to London when he complained about the traffic. Similarly, I can be referring to a deck of cards when I use the phrase the deck of cards. That doesn't mean that there's a thing in the world, a deck of cards, referred to by the phrase the deck of cards. Okay? What it means is that terms like book or deck of cards, in effect, provide a certain perspective for humans with which to talk about the world, whatever they think the world is. They provide a kind of a lens, or a prism or something. Here's a way you can look at things through this odd perspective. It's kind of Frege's telescope, if you want to go back to the imagery of Sinnen Bedeutung. But the telescope has very curious properties, way beyond what he imagined. Words like, and I think one should look at all words that way. All words of the language, or any language, they're not objects that stand in the referential relation to the world. They're objects that offer a certain framework or perspective or whatever for doing what's called talking about the world. They may roughly pick out a certain shifting region in a very complex space of human interests and concerns, but they never get any closer to reference than that, except just by accident. Take some other ones. Take the word house, let's say. And consider what you know about houses. So suppose, for example, John painted the house brown. So here's the house. John painted it brown. What that means is John painted the outer surface brown. If John painted the inner surface brown, he didn't paint the house brown. Okay. So somehow the house is its outer surface. The outer surface of the house is kind of a mathematical object. So the house is some kind of an abstract object, namely its outer surface. Similarly, if I say John saw the house, okay, it means he saw the outer surface. If John is out here, say, and he's looking into, here's John, and he's, let's say there's a shield there, so all he can do is look into the window. John's looking into the window of the house, he can't see anything else, and he sees the inner walls fine, but he's still not seeing the house. He's got to somehow see the outer surface in order to see the house. So a house is apparently an abstract object, namely an outer surface. On the other hand, it's certainly not just the abstract object. For example, if John is, if this were in fact just a surface, you could be near the house. John could be equidistant. If John and Mary are equal distances from this surface, they would be equidistant from the house, and that's obviously not true, because Mary's in the house. Because if you're in it, you can't be at a certain distance from it. So the house is not a surface. If John is near the house, John might be near the house, depending on our current conditions for nearness, but Mary can't be near the house because she's